Welcome to The Insider, the members-only podcast featuring War on the Rocks authors. This show will explore in depth a feature article every week and why it matters for national security. My name is Nick Danforth, editor and host of the show. With that, let's dive in. This week, we're talking about secure visas for Afghan National Army Special Operations Command, an article by Sean Kingsland and Dr. Aaron McPhee. Sean is a U.S. Marine Corps veteran and rising sophomore at the University of Chicago, majoring in political science. He studied Pashto at the Defense Language Institute and served as a cryptologic linguist and signals intelligence analyst with the Marine Corps' 1st Radio Battalion, and he is now at the Coriolis Institute. Dr. McPhee is a professor of practice at the William J. Perry Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies at the National Defense University, and she is also the president and chair of the Coriolis Institute, a UKRI Future Leaders Fellow at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and an affiliated faculty at the Carter School for Peace and Conflict Resolution. That is not all. Also, lead researcher at the University of Chicago's Office for Military Affiliated Communities. So thank you both for coming on here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
To start out, give us a sense of who the Afghan National Army Special Operations Command was and what they did.
They were a group that was stood up together with the U.S. Special Operations Forces during the last 10 years of the war in Afghanistan. They were trained by and alongside our SOF community, as well as others. And now, you know, many were evacuated August 2021 and find themselves resettling in a variety of countries, but many of them are in the United States. Certainly, you know, there are many who were left behind and who are still looking for pathways out of the country. But these were some of the folks that participated in a study that we conducted together with Honor the Promise a couple of years ago, last summer, actually.
And real quick, an interesting portrait of how important these forces were to the Afghan National Army. One government report found that 80% of the offensives taking place in 2018 were conducted by the ANASOC forces, while they only made up only 6% of the Afghan National Army.
And give us a sense, I mean, who were the people who joined? Who were these individuals?
There was certainly a wide range, right? I mean, all the veteran populations are always a heterogeneous community, but certainly among the individuals that we interviewed, so we conducted 36 life history interviews with folks who were resettling all across the United States. We had a team of about four of us doing that. And, you know, we spoke with people that came from very privileged backgrounds connected to the political elite in Afghanistan. One individual, for example, had the opportunity to attend and graduate from West Point prior to, you know, being part of the ANASOC community. And then there were other folks who came from much more humble beginnings. Quite a lot were motivated by seeing their parents and their grandparents and sort of what they had learned from them about previous occupations and wars and wanting to defend their country. Some of them had lost fathers and brothers to the Taliban. So these, in general, were people that were very motivated by love of country and wanting to protect their brothers and sisters from the Taliban in their country, but certainly a wide range of backgrounds.
In that case, these were presumably people who were specifically targeted by the Taliban at the end of the conflict. Take us through the different challenges they faced, who stayed in Afghanistan, who got out, what was the route for people who ultimately ended up in the United States?
Certainly a lot of what happened during the evacuation was a function of who they knew, who they were able to get a hold of, what NGOs were able to connect with them. It was chaos in many forms. Many books have been written already about the evacuation. So there's no shortage of information out there about all of the efforts that went into helping to get them out. But it was, you know, quite often a matter of calling people from that they had worked with in the U.S. SOF community, who then advocated on their behalf on the U.S. side or with particular organizations like No One Left Behind, for example, who was organizing a great many of the evacuations that were happening at that time and connecting with the community in order to get them out. Often they went through, you know, other countries first. Some are still struggling to get out of those first sort of ports of call. And then others were able to come a bit more quickly to the United States. I would say that fewer were able to sort of get immediately out of Afghanistan into the United States over the course of a handful of days or a few weeks. for many more, it was a months and months long process of camps equating to refugee camps coming to the United States, not knowing where they were going to end up. Many ended up in Midwestern states in the dead of winter, which is, you know, I'm sure they were quite happy to have arrived there, but perhaps another month would have been better. And then others were facilitated through more independent means, so through individual connections that were able to get them out in other areas. But there were, as you can imagine, quite a lot of directed targeting of these individuals by the Taliban. And so, you know, getting out was a very fraught proposition through any kind of the formal border crossings in the country as well.
And then once these ANISOC veterans got to the United States, they faced many of the problems for recent immigrants. They had trouble finding employment due to their status, a status that was very precarious and still is, relying on executive orders each year to stay in the United States instead of having a stable and reliable protected status. The employment that they did get was completely at odds with the training and the skills that they had achieved during their time in ANISOC, going from, you know, one of the best in their fields to manual labor and things, like I said, that did not match their skill set. Many veterans that we interviewed had family members that also served in special operations forces or in the Afghan National Army who have to move houses every couple of days to make sure that they stay ahead of the Taliban. And of course, many have wives and children that are still in Afghanistan. That separation from family was a huge talking point and subject in our interviews, one that was forefront in many veterans' minds.
What Sean was just saying reminded me of one of the individuals that we interviewed who said, well, there's two actually that made me think of. One who said that, and this is in the longer report that we published, that he avoids walking around parks or schools because it's too painful for him to watch the kids playing outside because of the fact that he had to leave his wife and children behind. Another individual that we interviewed who just has this incredible story of, you know, really being in Mazar-e-Sharif, just one of the last two guys out there and being pushed steadily backwards into the HQ, which was then empty by the time that they got there. The commander had abandoned them, you know, just saying that, I remember, I think I can quote almost directly, he says, "I'm an army man, I'm not a dishwasher." And so many of these guys want so much to serve still in the U.S. military or in some capacity. So there's still that heartfelt commitment to serving their country in some way, that country now being the United States. You know, another one said, "I wear clothes here, I eat here, I live here. I want to defend my country."
So, right, and that gets to the heart of your recommendation. Tell us what the special immigrant visa would enable these people to do, why it's important, and what the legislation related to this that's currently before the U.S. Congress is.
Yes, so the special immigrant visa is a specialized immigration pathway that was created by the Afghan Allies Protection Act, an earlier act, I think first passed in 2009, that provided this pathway to translators and other employees of the U.S. military, U.S. government, to immigrate to the United States. However, this act does not allow for, it's very specific to those who are paid by the U.S. government instead of anybody who were allies or might be in special danger, but, you know, did not meet those requirements. So we propose expanding the special immigrant visa definition and eligibility requirements to include those Afghan allies, especially ANISOC, who we did our research with, who are just as deserving of consideration and help and who are still in considerable danger from the Taliban. Now, this would be possible. This has already been proposed in a law that's before the Senate Judiciary Committee called the Afghan Adjustment Act that matches our suggestions almost exactly with also some eligibility requirements for other units other than ANISOC. But however, this has been stalled for years now. And though we have some promising signs, Senator Amy Klobuchar recently introduced an amendment that would take part of the Afghan Adjustment Act and dealing with record retention. So all our records that demonstrate and are evidence of these veterans' service, we will keep those records in order to in the future, hopefully, expedite their SIV or special immigration visa applications and make sure that we can we have those records on hand in order to help them. And that this seems to be the first step in hopefully getting all of the Afghan Adjustment Act into law.
Can I ask a little bit more about that? Because I know this has come up in pieces we published before, that one of the challenges for people in these situations is that, you know, I think this holds true, if I remember correctly, what we've published for people who did directly work with the U.S. government. I mean, right, that the records related to their actual service, be it in the Afghan army or for the United States, are in Afghanistan right now, are in places that have been taken over by the Taliban. I mean, there's a purely logistical angle to this, isn't there?
Certainly, there's a logistical angle of getting to them. But all of these individuals do have existing U.S. government records. They're biometrically enrolled. They've all been vetted. So in terms of, and certainly through networks of brothers, cousins of brothers, right? And I don't want to exclude the female tactical platoons, the FTP, the women who worked alongside them. And I'm only speaking exclusively of the ANISOC men because those are the individuals that we worked with, but not to foreground like a relative value. But all these guys are, you know, still sort of in contact with one another. So there can be knowledge of where they are and, you know, sort of ways to get to them. But yeah, certainly, you know, flying in and holding up a sign at the airport isn't going to work. But if they can get them out of the country, I think some of the work that we're focusing on too is, you know, what happens once they get here? So there were a couple of folks that I interviewed in UK actually, and these were women from the female tactical platoons for another study. The UK, for example, provides quite a lot more in terms of benefits for resettlement, pretty much ongoing English courses, which of course is going to be a huge impediment for getting jobs, employment, enrolling in schools and things like that. And then also issues with records, right? It's hard to enroll for a university if you don't have any of your documents with you. And sort of those kinds of processes are facilitated much better in the UK than they are here. So I think, you know, we're not working in the complete absence of models to inspire better and more efficient processing of these individuals. But yes, that is not to say that it is an easy task to get them out of the country to begin with. But what we're hoping we can achieve with this research is to, at a very bare minimum starting point, get the ones that are here processed in a much more sort of humane and dignified way, befitting of the services that they provided alongside our own operators and military forces.
Well, let me ask on that note, you've made the case for getting the special immigrant visas sorted out for passing the Afghan Adjustment Act. But beyond those legal measures, are there other things that the U.S. government, or even listeners for that matter, could do?
Yeah, I mean, since this will be coming out this week, I will add that there are fundraising efforts by Honor the Promise, which was actually founded by Dr. Lila Kohistani, who is one of the other podcast hosts for Sailor Pulse with War on the Rocks. And, you know, they do things ranging from there's a 5K this weekend to Run for Resiliency. So you can look up the information that's in the DC area on their website. Certainly No One Left Behind is another NGO that does incredible work, still getting folks out of the country. Honor the Promise is more narrowly dedicated to the ANISOC community and resettlement efforts. And then just advocating, you know, reaching out to your representatives and letting them know that this is a policy priority for you as well. But certainly in the immediate term and near term, checking out some of these organizations and seeing if there's a way that you would be able to contribute to them.
All right. Thank you so much. I hope listeners will listen to all of those recommendations. And I really appreciate you both writing about this and coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.